Feminist approaches to international relations theory in the post-Cold War period. Marcia Zalewski. This article reflects on the trajectory and development of feminist scholarship since the end of the Cold War. It begins with a statement of feminist intent, moving then to consider the post-Cold War introduction of feminist scholarship into the academic study of international politics, namely the discipline of international relations, IR. I will then offer some snapshots of key feminist approaches connecting these up with contemporary global political issues. The concluding sections will return to reconsider the opening statement of feminist intent, first through a discussion of four globally significant women, then offer my views on the contemporary relevance and import of feminist scholarship in the context of global politics, both in theory and in practice. Opening statement. All these theories, yet the bodies keep piling up. Zalewski, 1996. It is quite an undertaking to discuss the range of feminist approaches in relation to international politics over a 30-year period, not least given the vast amount of feminist scholarship that has been done over that time. But this opening statement, or pause for thought, is less about the commonplace challenge of academic distillation and review, but rather specifically connected to the relentless consistency of problematic assumptions made about this provocative body of thought, which can rob it of its primary worth. As such, I start with the statement that the work of feminist scholarship on global politics is largely intended to be powerfully destabilizing. This remains the case even if destabilization seems politically and educationally unpalatable. Undeniably, a primary aim of this corpus of feminist scholarship is to create a body of theory and practice with enough agency and traction to make significant structural, epistemological, conceptual, and political changes both to the ways international politics is studied, as well as fundamentally alter the violent ways in which much of global politics continues to manifest itself. It might be considered that this scholarly aim of feminist work sounds provocative and overly ambitious, not least given the consistently assumed goal of feminism is typically understood to be simply about including women into the varied realms of high politics. An accompanying assumption is that this inclusion is merely in the service of supporting the theoretical and political agendas of conventional international politics. My claim is that this branch of feminist scholarship has an exceedingly far-reaching aim, and indeed very similar to the one that the discipline of international politics itself was founded upon and has manifestly failed to achieve, namely to impose a significant halt to the egregious and relentless violence that continues to blight the contemporary global political landscape. Furthermore, the claim of feminist scholarship is that it has much greater potential than the discipline of international relations to bring about this kind of change. I open with this somewhat provocative statement as the serious intention and work of feminism can so readily evaporate. I hope to seize readers' attention in this important volume right from the start. The stakes are far too high to not take the destabilizing work of feminism seriously. Introduction, Feminist Scholarship and International Relations. The discipline of international relations, IR, is integrally linked to the rhythms of the global political landscape. Emerging as an academic discipline in 1919, subsequent to the horrors of the Second World War, IR's theorizing, methodological approaches and political attention have since been focused on producing effective knowledge about the international realm. Brecher and Harvey, 2005. Traditionally, this has involved attention to the more obvious political sites of states, government, politicians, and globally significant wars, with conceptual and empirical attention consistently revolving around security, anarchy, and violence. Theoretically, the discipline has been dominated for many decades by the triad realism, pluralism, and structuralism, though it is realism, a form of realpolitik, which remain the overwhelmingly dominant theoretical approach, Smith, 1994. It was not until the 1980s that other theoretical approaches began to garner some traction. Indeed, following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the emergence of the post-Cold War period, there was something of an explosion of theoretical approaches in IR. A list of these would include critical theory, postmodernism, post-structuralism, feminism, and constructivism, Brecker and Harvey, 2005. This plethora of the theories, especially compared to the previous six decades, spawned an abundance of articles, books, workshops, conferences, and new teaching programs, notably in the US, Canada, the UK, and Australia. In tandem with these theoretical inroads, critiques of the philosophical and epistemological underpinnings of most, if not all, conventional theories and methodological approaches was underway, typically framed as the post-positivist debate. Smith, Booth and Zalewski, 1996. As such, the post-Cold War period appears as a distinctly apposite political and intellectual moment from which to give an account of one of these new approaches, namely feminism. Yet, given the heavy dominance of realism for over six decades, it is important to question more closely why these global changes would have had such a disciplinary and theoretical impact. What exactly changed in 1989? The immediate post-Cold War period saw feminist scholarship entering a vigorous intellectual climate in the discipline of IR. One answer is that two stark instances of failure and surprise triggered the avalanche of new work in the discipline of IR. The surprise was the collapse of the Soviet Union and the thawing of the Cold War. The failure belonged to the discipline of IR. As Christine Sylvester put it, few realists of any ilk would have argued that states voluntarily go out of business and dismantle their territorial authorities. This the Soviet Union did, 2002-7. For scholars and practitioners of realpolitik, this abandonment of power and sovereignty was astonishing. And, as a discipline integrally connected to high political analysis and policymaking, especially in the United States, IR's failure of insight and predictive powers was forcibly felt. The rapidity of the changes led many to challenge academic understandings of international politics, focusing attention on IR's limitations, Brown, 1993-2. Further fueled by many of the insights of continental philosophy, insights which had been taken up in other disciplines such as sociology and political theory some decades before, epistemological critiques of IR's theoretical foundations grew exponentially. As such, this confluence of IR's theoretical weakness and a potentially unruly world order paved the way for theoretical and empirical intrusion by a host of scholars ushering in the destabilizing decade of the 1980s. Sylvester, 2002-9. Here, feminism took center stage with conferences and workshops for mainstream IR audiences in London, Boston, and Los Angeles, the birth of the Feminist and Gender Studies section of the International Studies Association and the Gender and International Relations Group at the British International Studies Association. These developments worked to place feminist scholars and their work in institutionally recognized positions. Books and articles then proliferated, and mainstream IR teaching programs began to include some feminist or gender courses, at least on the Anglo-American educational scene. Thus, the immediate post-Cold War period saw feminist scholarship entering a vigorous intellectual climate in the discipline of IR. One of the groundbreaking books published at that time was Cynthia N. Lowe's Bananas, Beaches and Bases, 1989. This remains a core text in the study of feminist international politics to this day. In 1989, it was notable for its prolific use of visual methodologies, its very limited reference to the core theories, texts or authors of conventional IR, and, crucially, its central attention to women and the workings of gender specifically masculinity and femininity, both in the context of behaviours and concepts. This inevitably meant that bananas, beaches and bases focused on sites of international politics long deemed irrelevant, trivial or simply domestic, including diplomatic wives, prostitution, tourism and domestic servants. In Lowe's groundbreaking 1989 book, is rightly credited for starting an intellectual and political feminist trail, exposing how deeply the international political system was indebted to the work of women and the working of masculinity and femininity. This work was not simply about women, it was about demonstrating that by focusing on women and gender, it could be much more clearly illustrated the extent to which power goes into the constitution of international politics than conventional theories could comprehend. As in Lowe put it, the international politics of debt, investment, colonization, national security, diplomacy and trade are far more complicated than most experts would have us believe. 1989-197. Post-1989 in feminist theory and practice. In the midst of a fluid European order, and the sudden loss of what was assumed to have been a stable bipolar world, Smith, 1994, the immediate post-Cold War era seemed an unlikely time to focus undivided attention on Cynthia Enloe's central question about international politics, which was, and largely remains, where are the women? Though, in the context of the New Europe, it was becoming increasingly apparent that women were regularly faring badly, especially in the former Eastern Europe. In one of the more obvious sites of politics, political participation and representation, women had previously been very active. Post-1989, their representation began to rapidly decline. Einhorn, 1992. As contemporary writers noted, women had been present at the big demonstrations, on the happy streets, but disappeared from the negotiating tables, KISS, 1991. In employment too, women were amongst the biggest losers. Additionally, their reproductive rights became a prime target for political management, often becoming the first issue to which post-communist governments turned their attention, KISS, 1991, Einhorn, 1993. However, in order to properly cultivate feminist analyses post-1989, rigorous theoretical analyses were clearly called for. Early formulations of feminist scholarship in IR included developing theoretical typologies, specifically liberal, socialist Marxist, radical, and postmodern. This was accompanied by more philosophically inspired analyses with the labels empiricist, standpoint, and poststructural, Zalewski, 1993. Liberal and social Marxist feminisms were obviously aligned politically with liberalism and socialist Marxism. Thus, liberal feminism drew heavily on liberalism, paying clear attention to the sanctity of the human self and all the rights that have developed attached to that self, especially since the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. Ostensibly simple, liberal feminist scholars wanted the rights of man to extend to include the rights of woman. Key to this kind of analysis was the distinction between sex and gender, which in truth was a groundbreaking move within the annals of feminist thought as it severed the supposedly natural or biological realm of sex from the culturally and socially constructed realm of gender. If women had traditionally appeared to not belong in the political or public realm, or not to have the same rights as men, given their more natural or indeed God-given private or familial and reproductive roles, the relatively new knowledge that women were simply humans too meant women might, indeed should be included empirically, representationally, as well as in theoretical analysis. That women were not included in this way, in relation to the study and practices of international politics, was manifestly apparent. Indeed, the absence of women in the teaching of IR or the authorship of work on international politics works was stark. As J. Ann Tickner noted about the discipline of IR in 1992, "Why are there so few women in my discipline? If I teach the field as it is conventionally defined, why are there so few readings by women to assign to my students? Why is the subject matter of my discipline so distant from women's lived experiences? Why have women been conspicuous only by their absence in the worlds of diplomacy and military and foreign policy making? 1992-1. Why have women been conspicuous only by their absence in the worlds of diplomacy and military and foreign policy making? The absence of women in the high political landscape of wars, interstate relationships, and political leadership was indeed obvious. The lack of interest in what might be regarded as women's more traditional activities and concerns was clearly securely regarded as an appropriate omission. What use could theorizing motherhood or domestic work be to the study and practice of global politics? It might be the case that women were sometimes visible as occasional leaders or mythical warriors, but the high politics of the international was very clearly understood as man's work, oftentimes explicitly stated as such even today. As such, a central aim for liberally inspired feminists was to have the equal worth to men of women recognized, for women to have the same political and public opportunities as men, and crucially, for gender, that cultural artifice deemed responsible for so much damage, to steadily evaporate with the end aim of a future without gender. A just future would be one without gender. In its social structures and practices, one's sex would have no more relevance than one's eye color or the length of one's toes. Okin, 1989-171. How has liberal feminism fared in global politics? There are many women political leaders now, still a minority, if perhaps a decreasing one. Women serve in large numbers in militaries around the world, and the bans on women serving in close combat are disappearing almost daily. Gender, as a concept, has been mainstreamed in the thinking and practice of many national governments and international organizations. The United Nations is a key actor here, not least since the groundbreaking Security Council Resolution 1325, introduced in 2000, which was the first formal and legal document from the Security Council that required parties in a conflict to prevent violations of women's rights, to support women's participation in peace negotiations and in post-conflict reconstruction, and to protect women and girls from sexual and gender-based violence. The two most recent relevant resolutions include SCR 2106 and SCR 2122, both in 2013. In many ways, the success of liberal feminism seems clear, though for many feminist international relations scholars, this success is dubious. It is the case that the majority of feminist scholars welcome inclusive practices for women. Rather, the troubling issue relates to the tacit acceptance of conventional, oftentimes articulated as mainstream, political and theoretical agendas and practices. Plus, the acceptance of the standard of human, which is, by historical default, most often elite, white and male. As a corollary liberal feminist work tends to support the invisibility and lesser worth of women's traditional lives, behaviors and work, by default ignoring the imbalances and biases and discriminations this wreaks upon many women globally. In the current geopolitical order, liberal feminism has, many argue, been co-opted in the service of neoliberal agendas and practices. I will return to this point. As might be expected, the philosophical underpinnings and political commitments of socialist Marxist feminisms are integrally connected to analyses of the economic realm and the class system. The conjoining of Marxist work on the economy, class and capitalism and the everyday turmoil of lived lives, along with the socialist feminist's emphasis on the distinctive use value and exploitation of women in the global system, has produced a wealth of insightful scholarship on global gendered political economies. Early work included Miriam Mee's tracing of work of the consumer housewife as an exemplar of the optimal labor force 1986, both in the underdeveloped and overdeveloped countries, 1986-126. Also, Cynthia Enloe's work on the gendered politics of the banana, through the figure and life of the singer Carmen Miranda, 1989-2014. Enloe also began the dense trail of work tracking the international use of domestic servants and the links with international debt policies, 1989-2014. Significant conceptual work in the area of gender and political economy has demonstrated that perceptions about appropriate roles for men and women and accompanying race and class dimensions saturated and structured many of these personal kinds of decisions and activities. Beliefs around romance and love, as well as reproduction and family honour, nurtured rich grounds for huge reservoirs of cheap or free labour. However, they remained typically understood as private, domestic, and/or cultural, and certainly not the business of international politics analysts. Currently, the tracks of this work are theoretically and practically very well illustrated in the Global North's entrepreneurial ambitions for women and girls in the Global South. One example of this involves the corporate social responsibility agendas of international big business and finance. The World Bank, for example, has embarked on major collaborations with two private sector actors, the Global Private Sector Leaders Forum and the Girl Effect Campaign, see Calkin 2016, also Calkin 2015. The latter is also notable for its sports conglomerate and celebrity endorsements. Philanthropic intentions notwithstanding, Sidney Calkin argues, that the commingling of gender and big business finance capitalizes on the potential entrepreneurial power and resources of women and girls in a globalized economy in the service of agendas of the Global North. The political use of gender to pursue the humanitarian and other agendas of the Global North is not new. A significant moment marking the immediate post-9/11 period was the radio address by the then First Lady Laura Bush on the plight of the women of Afghanistan, offering further rationale for the subsequent invasion by the United States. Serious questions remain in the current international political landscape about the ever-increasing economic and development focus on women and girls, including Girl Effect, Girl Up, Girl Rising, Girls 20 Summit, Because I Am a Girl, Let Girls Learn, Girl Declaration. What might we make of the current use of gender as a tool of such financial and political use value to the Global North? The final dual stream of feminist theorizing work in international relations involves radical and postmodern feminism, which are both much less obviously connected to familiar political commitments or the conventional political spectrum. Though the radical tributary of feminist work is very closely associated with revolutionary and resistance political and social movements evident in many Western societies in the 1960s and 1970s, including women's rights and civil rights Black Power movements. A central aim of this genre of work was to place women at the center of political and analytical attention, and to raise issues traditionally of more concern to women, right to the top of political, education and cultural agendas. Where are the women? A deceptively important question at the core of much radical feminist work appears a seemingly benign one at one level, or just an empirical or issued-based one. Yet it raises profound epistemological questions about the foundations and systems of knowledge going back to the alleged founding fathers of modern thinking, including Plato and Aristotle, as well as those more recent such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, John Stuart Mill, and Immanuel Kant, to name just a few. The critique of foundational knowledges is also a hallmark of postmodern and/or post-structural feminisms. I will return to these points. In the subsequent three decades since the end of the Cold War, a vast amount of feminist scholarship has been produced, and gender has become central to United Nations policy and discourse. Women and gender, it seems, have a secure place in the theory and practice of international politics. Currently, in feminist IR scholarship, the four-pronged typology of feminist theory, which I have introduced, are less visibly deployed. However, they were very much part of the development of the field. Subsequent academic work represents more of an amalgam of approaches, perhaps with a leaning towards post-structural methods, and with a great deal more work being done using post-colonial, queer theory, and associative creative methodological approaches, which includes analyses of images and popular culture and the everyday. I want to move now to add some nuance to the discussion by taking a brief diversion to consider four women of international political significance, two contemporary and two from ancient times. Four women. The four globally significant women are Aung San Suu Kyi, Malala Yousafzai, Athena, and Medusa. First, I will briefly introduce them, moving them to consider some reasons we might regard them as important to reflect on, if in something of an interlude in this essay, in a consideration of international politics and feminist theorizing. Aung San Suu Kyi and Malala Yousafzai are two women very much in the current international political media and spotlight. Aung San Suu Kyi, known colloquially as the Lady, is well known for her long fight for democracy in Myanmar. A woman regularly presented in the Western media as an enigmatic, even romantic figure, described by one commentator as fragrant. She was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. She has been in the news more recently for allegedly turning a blind eye to what has been described as the ethnic cleansing of the minority of Rohingya Muslim community in Myanmar. In an open letter to the UN Security Council, more than a dozen Nobel laureates have criticized Aung San Suu Kyi for a bloody military crackdown on minority Rohingya people, warning of a tragedy amounting to ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity. As a young girl in Pakistan, Malala Yousafzai was very active and vocal, including blogging, about the right for girls to be educated. She was shot in 2012 by the Taliban at the age of 15, on her way to school for her views and activism. Malala, known worldwide for her first name, especially since the publication of her 2013 biography, came to England for medical treatment, recovering well enough from her injuries to begin going to high school in Birmingham. She continued to speak up for the rights of girls to be educated, and in 2014, Malala became the youngest person ever to win the Nobel Peace Prize. In 2017, she was appointed UN Ambassador for Peace and took up a place as an undergraduate at Oxford University. She was also one of the Nobel Prize-winning signatories of the open letter to the UN Security Council rebuking Aung San Suu Kyi. Two globally significant women on the contemporary international political scene. How do their stories and lives help us to better to understand the work and significance of feminist international relations scholarship? Not contemporary women, but a strong lingering presence in political, social, and cultural imaginations are Athena and Medusa. Athena, a mythical Greek goddess of wisdom, war, heroism, and crafts, the capital of Greece still bears her name. In UK culture, her emblem, spirit, and name has been taken up by the Equality Challenge Unit, which spearheads and directs gender equality charters in some of the UK's top educational and research institutions. The Athena Swan Charter. One of Athena's memorable deeds was to transform Medusa's head into a terrifying sight, one swarming and writhing with hissing snakes, holding the power to turn men into stone if she caught their eye. A head ultimately severed by Perseus at the bidding of Athena. Statues of Perseus brandishing the severed head of Medusa is a regular feature in museums around the world. Women remain marked by her gender. Indeed, their gender tends to disallow more than one iconic status at a time. The story of Medusa has challenged its way right through into the 21st century. The most recent mediatized reincarnation of this image has Donald Trump in the place of Perseus and Hillary Clinton as the severed head of Medusa, Beard, 2017. And though there are many ancient variations of the story, one particular version persists. Medusa was the only one of three sisters, known as Gorgons, that was born a mortal. The story has it that Medusa was once very beautiful, but was cursed by Athena, who gave her snakes for hair. Medusa's misdemeanor had been to violate the sanctity of one of Athena's temples by laying with Poseidon. This story of punishment and Medusa's eventual beheading by Perseus has powerful contemporary resonance. Yet, as Mary Beard 2017 and Susan Bowers 1990 articulate, a different story might have held imaginations and had subsequent philosophical and epistemological import. The one in which Poseidon raped Medusa and Athena's punishment was rather to save Medusa from ever being violated again. All four women are iconic, and all four are embroiled in global politics in one form or another. They stand as emblematic figures of womanhood, though they matter and come to matter in our thinking about international politics, if in different ways. The question of Aung San Suu Kyi's ostensibly vacillating position as a harbinger of peace is not one at issue here. Readers will have varying views on this. Rather, we might think about her iconic status in relation to liberal feminist visions of female inclusion, especially as global political leaders. It is very clear that we cannot ever count on women acting in peaceful ways, though it seems the case female leaders are rarely able to escape being identified by their gender, usually as icons at one end of the good woman, bad woman spectrum or the other, as warriors, peaceniks, heroines, or simply evil. Women remain marked by her gender. Indeed, their gender tends to disallow more than one iconic status at a time. Malala's gender placing in the contemporary geopolitical landscape story has become particularly attractive to Western audiences, not least given it fits very easily into the colonialist furrow that Gayatri Spivak, 1985, so powerfully and succinctly articulated as white men saving brown women from brown men. At the same time that Malala's story supports traditional masculine lace politics of protection, it also has been given the air of a neoliberal feminist success story, an individualist female triumph over the dark forces of gender traditionalism. One extraordinary woman intrepidly emerging from a mass of ordinary women, and think of the way women from the greater Middle East region are regularly depicted by the media, but also so eagerly requisitioned by powerful Western political institutions, is significant. And it is striking that the mythical figures of iconic womanhood, Athena and Medusa, still lay claim to contemporary popular and philosophical imaginations. That one of the most impactful ways to represent the battle between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at the time of the US presidential campaign and election in 2016-2017, humorous intent notwithstanding, using the hypergendered and brutal reincarnation of the conventional and long-standing narrative of Perseus, Athena, and Medusa. This reveals a great deal about how contemporary knowledge systems work. 21st century. Men my age dictate this war, Mr. Dawson in Dunkirk. What rises to the mediatized surface of current global political landscapes? What assails our vision and minds on a daily basis? One thing that has clearly changed radically since the end of the Cold War is the vast development of the internet and associated social media use. A current globally significant example of this, an exemplar of sorts, is US President Donald Trump's Twitter habit. As I write, the possibilities of a potential nuclear war with via North Korea is taking Twitter center stage. Other focal points in my daily news feed include the plight of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. Brexit, of course, especially from my vantage point as someone living in the United Kingdom. And culturally, one of the latest big movies is Dunkirk, perhaps, coincidentally, released in the midst of some turmoil around Brexit negotiations. A film full of men, of course, and almost no men of colour, and with one of two women, perhaps, hard to catch sight of them. Does this matter? Is the stark white maleness of a popular movie something we should pay attention to as IR scholars when we are faced with a US president threatening the annihilation of another country as he did in his first speech to the United Nations in September 2017? Or in a world in which the Russian president and North Korean leader relentlessly exhibit variable levels of behaviour of what might be called vexatious masculinities? And what of the SLU, or hurricanes wreaking havoc in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea? Questions about climate change and environmental degradation are surely high on our international political agendas, if intermittently, though it is, of course, the poorest people who suffer most. No change there. The main contemporary change is that celebrities come to the rescue in much more visible and self-promoting ways than ever possible before without social media. Beginning with the recognition that women and the traditionally feminine have been rendered absent or irrelevant in the realm of international politics, it appears that the remedy is not simply to add women in as if they were men. There is something of an obsession with the idea of dramatic changes in our political landscapes, often taken for granted as the ones to pay close attention to, such as the end of the Cold War. Instead, we might focus for a moment on the film Dunkirk, a major drama from the past, of course, but in popular culture form, it does not readily appear to be of much significance in the context of the concerns of this volume. My daughter wonders why there are so few women in it. Surely a woman could have been cast at the helm of the small boat or at the centre of the film's rescue narrative. Or a teenage daughter rather than a son slipping unnoticed into the craft so he could join his father and elder brother in the rescue mission. Of course, it is a film about an event in the Second World War. So a film of its time, a common assumption being that history cannot simply be rewritten to satisfy the morals and much less the gender agendas of the early 21st century. There has, however, been much social media chatter about the whitewashing of the film, and indeed the dubious Blitz spirit in part dovetailing nicely with the current revival of protecting the homeland spirit prevalent in both the UK and the US. But how very easy it has been to render unknown the violence, not least the rapes and sexual assaults, that took place so regularly during bombing raids in the Second World War. Scholars of feminist international relations insistently ask which stories of the many available retain or return to take center stage, whether about war or the global economy or appropriate work for men and women. Which of these stories persistently rise to the surface and retain political and theoretical attention? I suggest to my daughter that Dunkirk is very much a film about male heroism, and though any director might choose to bend the facts a little to tell and sell a story, female heroism does not have the same impact or storytelling facility. It is the case that a good many recent highly popular films, such as Eye in the Sky and Zero Dark Thirty, blockbusters which capture the attention of millions of people worldwide, feature female leads are often seen in senior military roles. Though recent research suggests that these female leads, always white, function to promote a form of ethical whiteness, Charania 2017, once again supporting conventional international political agendas. I opened with a somewhat provocative statement about the intent of feminist scholarship. It might be perceived that I overstate the case to draw attention, yet I maintain that the feminist critique of the underlying knowledge structures on which studies of international politics relies, and which are drawn from long-standing philosophical, political, and even mythical foundations, poses a very significant challenge. Being with the recognition that women and the traditionally feminine have been rendered absent or irrelevant in the realm of international politics, it appears that the remedy is not simply to add women in as if they were men. The challenge to the study and practice of international politics demands much more rigorous and effective work in both theory and practice. There have been some notable changes on the global political landscape since 1989, but just a cursory glance will confirm hardly a dent in the realm of global violence, perhaps an increase. Of course, feminist scholarship cannot resolve all these violences, but the vast corpus of knowledge produced since 1989, knowledge which stems for questions drawn from the submerged work and activities of more than half the world's population, bears much more serious and sustained attention.